So, welcome again. This evening, we're continuing in this first chapter of the second book, Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations, and the Indeterminable. Sri Aurobindo has described that there is a consciousness force, omnipresent, acting in the world, but as we meet it in our first experience of nature at the material level, it seems to be met both as knowledge and as ignorance. We see the inconscience first. We meet it as this blanked out, unaware existence which somehow is there. It is an indeterminate, that is to say, there are no boundaries. We have no way of assaying, of measuring what it is that we meet, measuring in terms of extent, measuring in terms of depth and essence. So our knowledge, as we arrive at some appraisal of the universe, is more a description of the processes we discover and less of a penetration into the why. We understand, as he comes to say, the practical how, but not the intrinsic how of this world. And then he opens with this next paragraph that we'll start with, this wonderful phrase, "There is more to perplex us. For we see the original indeterminate energy throwing out general determinants of itself. We might act, we might equally, in their relation to the variety of their products, call them generic indeterminates, with their appropriate states of substance and determined forms of that substance. The latter are numerous, sometimes innumerable, variations on the substance energy which is their base. But none of these variations seems to be predetermined by anything in the nature of the general indeterminate." So the original indeterminate is an energy without boundary. We come to that, and then we see deriving from it generic indeterminates, which also seem to be unbounded, even if they have some appropriate states of relationship and substantiation. But as he says, none of these variations seems to be predetermined by anything that inheres in that indeterminate something. In other words, ultimately, causation is questioned if we have a situation where this somewhat brings something out of being into becoming. Do we know why it came out? Has it been predetermined by an ordering law within itself? So these possibilities that it is not so have to be examined each in succession. So an electric energy produces positive, negative, neutral forms of itself, forms that are at once waves and particles. A gaseous state of energy substance produces a considerable number of different gases. A solid state of energy substance, from which results the earth principle, prithvi, develops into different forms of earth and rock of many kinds and numerous minerals and metals. A life principle produces its vegetable kingdom teeming with a countless foison, means plenty, of quite different plants, trees, flowers. A principle A principle of animal life produces an enormous variety of genus, species, individual variations. So it proceeds into human life and mind and its mind types towards the still unwritten end, or perhaps the yet occult sequel of that unfinished evolutionary chapter. So, leaving only the state of liquidity out, he's traced the process of matter from the electric energy at the beginning to a gaseous state, to a solid state, to emerging life, to the amplitude of animal life, and into the human life and mind, and maybe something yet beyond it if there's an unwritten and hidden chapter yet to be revealed. And he says now, throughout there is the constant rule of a general sameness in the original determinate, and subject to this substantial sameness of basic substance and nature, a profuse variation in the generic and individual determinants. An identical law obtains of sameness or similarity in the genus or species with numerous variations, often meticulously minute in the individual. What are the defining boundaries and the ordering process of energetic expression? And then, once determined, what does this energy do but operate precisely and consistently? But he says, we do not find anything in any general or generic determinant necessitating the variant determinations that result from it. A necessity of immutable sameness at the base. The free and unaccountable variations on the surface seems to be the law, but who or what necessitates or determines? Again, he's looking for the cause or the inner reason. What is the rationale of the determination? What is its original truth or its significance? What compels or impels this exuberant play of varying possibilities which seem to have no aim or meaning unless it be the beauty or delight of creation? This is his view. A mind seeking and curious inventive thought, a hidden determining will, might be there, but there is no trace of it in the first and fundamental appearance of material nature. Yes, he's speaking of the material organization of the universe rising from the inconscience at this point. We're directly meeting the rule, the law, the reality of the inconscient. Why is it so? Why can this come to be out of an originating consciousness force which is omnipresent? Why do we arrive at this apparent negation of consciousness, this absence of ordering truth? And here's his first offering. A first possible explanation points to a self-organizing dynamic chance that is at work, a paradox necessitated by the appearance of inevitable order on one side, of unaccountable freak and fantasy on the other side of the cosmic phenomenon we call nature. And a paradox means literally contrary to perceived opinion, beyond or farther than the perceived opinion. So the paradox here is a chance that seems to establish an inevitable order, but also something that seems freakish and fantastic on the other side. How can they occupy the same space? So this first one is dynamic chance. An inconscient and inconsequent force, we may say, that acts at random and creates this or that by a general chance without any determining principle. Determinations coming in only as the result of a persistent repetition of the same rhythm of action, and succeeding because only this repetitive rhythm could succeed in keeping things in being. This is the energy of nature. Now, this is very like David Hume's philosophy and idea of what is causation or the absence of causation. But this implies that somewhere in the origin of things, there is a boundless possibility, or a womb of innumerable possibilities that are manifested out of it by the original energy, an incalculable inconscient, which we find some embarrassment in calling either an existence or a non-existence. For without some such origin and basis, the appearance and the action of the energy is unintelligible. So, philosophically, we feel unfulfilled unless we can say that there is something, some kind of an origin from which this arises. Even if it seems to be random, we expect there to be something there before the beginning. And we see, obviously, even in physics today, that we're constantly looking for that state of reality that underlies the emergence of all subatomic particles. What is that thing? So we are still looking for the source of this causation. Yet, an opposite aspect of the nature of the cosmic phenomenon as we see it appears to forbid the theory of a random action generating a persistent order. So if everything comes out of it randomly, why should it ever fall into order? What forces it to fall into order? We can't deny the possibility that the emergence of something from an inconscient is a random occurrence. We can't at this point anyway. So how do we balance the random with the linked causation that we also experience? He says, there is too much of an iron insistence on order, on a law basing the possibilities. The possibilities may be endless, but something forces them to cohere. If randomness is the launching pad, then how do we arrive at an ordered cosmos? One would be justified rather in supposing that there is an inherent imperative truth of things unseen by us, but a truth capable of manifold manifestation, throwing out a multitude of possibilities and variants of itself, which the creative energy by its action turns into so many realized actualities. Now, this gets closer to his own view of things, obviously, is that there is in this omnipresent conscious force the ordering principle of a real idea, which even though it seems to disappear into inconscience, is still there, vibrant with an ordering power. And now he set us up for his next possibility. This brings us to a second explanation, a mechanical necessity in things, its workings recognizable by us as so many mechanical laws of nature, the necessity, we might say, of some such secret inherent truth of things as we have supposed governing automatically the processes we observe in action in the universe. So this idea goes all the way back to Greek philosophy, with which Sri Aurobindo would have had some familiarity. Ananke. But a theory of mechanical necessity, he says, by itself does not elucidate the free play of the endless, unaccountable variations which are visible in the evolution. There must be behind the necessity or in it a law of unity associated with a coexistent, but dependent law of multiplicity, both insisting on manifestation. But the unity of what? The multiplicity of what? Again, he's seeking to fix and unify a being at the base of the multiplicity. All of these possibles have a right to come into self-expression, or into expression, let us say. But we can't account for the unity of the multiplicity. If we say that necessity is what drives it and enforces the unity, well, necessity might not give free vein to the possibilities ordering themselves or expressing themselves. Necessity, you see, this goes back to the Greek idea that if there is a necessity, you would have to say that no other state of affairs is possible. If this is necessary, nothing else is possible. This and this must exist. This alone must follow its own law of action. Thus, for the Greeks and the atomists led by Democritus, the world-creating motion of atoms in their whirl came by necessity out of their initially random movements. So you hear these echoed in Sri Aurobindo's language. Necessity. Things acting at random, that is to say, according to haphazard occurrence. So this idea of atomism is at the basis of this Greek view of what is the law of necessity, which reverberates quite a ways through the rest of Western philosophy, and we see it arriving here as a possibility to be considered as we look at the universe and try to decide how is it that we arrive at this arrangement of things. So he continues, let me possibly reread this sentence again. But a theory of mechanical necessity by itself does not elucidate the free play of the endless, unaccountable variations which are visible in the evolution. There must be, behind the necessity or in it, a law of unity associated with a coexistent but dependent law of multiplicity, both insisting on manifestation, but the unity of what? The multiplicity of what? Mechanical necessity can give no answer. Again, the emergence of consciousness out of the inconscient is a stumbling block in the way of this theory, for it is a phenomenon which can have no place in an all-pervading truth of inconscient mechanical necessity. In other words, we can't explain how consciousness rises from what is not conscious. He continues, if there is a necessity which compels the emergence of consciousness, it can be only this, that there is already a consciousness concealed in the inconscient, waiting for evolution, and when all is ready, breaking out from its prison of apparent nescience, nescience being a word for ignorance, absence of knowledge, of scientia. And this is an argument which has a certain force. If consciousness is not somehow involved, embedded in the very sinews of nature, how can it ever emerge? What freakish occurrence could make consciousness arise out of what is dumbly unconscious? He continues, we may indeed get rid of the difficulty of the imperative order of things by supposing that it does not exist, that determinism in nature is imposed on it by our thought, which needs such an imperative order to enable it to deal with its surroundings. But in reality, there is no such thing. There is only a force experimenting in a random action of infinitesimals, which build up in their general results different determinations by a repetitive persistence operative in the sum of their action. Thus, we go back from necessity to chance as the basis of our existence. So we would be reifying determinism. In other words, we have an idea and we thrust it upon nature and say, this is so. We're projecting a conception that has arisen in our mind upon nature and saying that it is real in the way that we conceive of it. This, again, is David Hume. This is in his examination of the principle of causation. You know, this is the principle of association, which means that we look at the affairs of the world. We follow what seems to be a line of causation. We determine that when this happens, that follows it. And because one thing resembles another, through that process of resemblance, we then arrive at an abstraction, which is not a true construction, not a true reflection, but something, again, imposed from the order of the mind upon the passive universe. To us, it is real, but it may not be real, in fact. And so we have to give up this idea of necessity and go back to chance, if that is true. So, but what then is this mind, this consciousness, which differs so radically from the energy that produced it, that for its action it has to impose its idea and need of order on the world she has made and in which it is obliged to live? Because whether this occurs in our mind or not, mind is somehow here. So mind is an element of the universe, regardless of how ambiguous the data are that we gather in our examination of the physical sciences. There would then be the double contradiction of consciousness emerging from a fundamental inconscience and of a mind of order and reason manifesting as the brilliant final consequence of a world created by inconscient chance. These things may be possible, but they need a better explanation than any yet given before we can accord to them our acceptance. So, first, consciousness arises out of the inconscience, really. And then the crown of all of this is a mind which is looking to impose some kind of order on what is an undetermined chance. So we arrive now at a third possibility. This opens the way for other explanations which make consciousness the creator of this world out of an apparent original inconscience. A mind, a will, seems to have imagined and organized the universe, but it has veiled itself behind its creation. Its first direction has been this screen of an inconscient energy and a material form of substance. At once, a disguise of its presence and a plastic creative basis on which it could work as an artisan uses for his production of forms and patterns a dumb and obedient material. Now, if you've studied Western theology, this is a very familiar argument. The creator is like an artist who takes this material and builds things. So, to continue, all these things we see around us are then the thoughts of an extra cosmic divinity, a being with an omnipotent and omniscient mind and will, who is responsible for the mathematical law of the physical universe, for its artistry of beauty, for its strange play of samenesses and variations, of concordances and discords, of combining and intermingling opposites, for the drama of consciousness struggling to exist and seeking to affirm itself in an inconscient universal order. So all this is married together in this view, because the world is a direct expression of the ideas of an extra cosmic divinity. Extra cosmic means a god who is outside the universe. So very much like this artisan who creates, but it's not within himself. He's creating this stuff outside of his own being. The fact, Sri Aurobindo writes, that this divinity is invisible to us, undiscoverable by our mind and senses, offers no difficulty, since self-evidence or direct sign of an extra cosmic creator could not be expected in a cosmos which is void of his presence. He has not written his signature upon the world anywhere. Because remember, he's outside the universe in this view. The patent signals everywhere of the works of an intelligence, of law, design, formula, adaptation of means to end, constant and inexhaustible invention, fantasy even, but restrained by an ordering reason, might be considered sufficient proof of this origin of things. Or if this creator is not entirely supracosmic, but is also immanent in his works, even then, there need be no other sign of him, except indeed to some consciousness evolving in this inconscient world, but only when its evolution reached a point at which it became aware of the indwelling presence. So in this codicil, Sri Aurobindo says that a creator could be discoverable when we evolve enough in consciousness to perceive it. Then we can detect and feel that indwelling presence. The intervention of this evolving consciousness, he writes, would not be a difficulty, since there would be no contradiction of the basic nature of things in its appearance. An omnipotent mind could easily infuse something of itself into its creatures. One difficulty remains. It is the arbitrary nature of the creation, the incomprehensibility of its purpose, the crude meaninglessness of its law of unnecessary ignorance, strife, and suffering, its ending without a denouement or issue. A play? But why this stamp of so many undivine elements and characters in the play of one whose nature must be supposed to be divine? To the suggestion that what we see worked out in the world is the thoughts of God, the retort can be made that God could well have had better thoughts, and the best thought of all would have been to refrain from the creation of an unhappy and unintelligible universe. So again, we've arrived all the way back at theodicy, the idea that how do we justify the presence of evil in the world? Why would this God outside the world, or perhaps he leans into it a little bit, still create something which is so full of suffering, with such bleak opportunities, and with an end to life which is more a whipper than a revelation? All theistic explanations of existence, starting from an extra-cosmic deity, stumble over this difficulty and can only evade it. It would disappear only if the creator were, even though exceeding the creation, yet immanent in it, himself in some sort, both the player and the play, an infinite casting infinite possibilities into the form of an evolutionary cosmic order. And of course, put briefly, this is Sri Aurobindo's view of the cosmos. So then we can move to a fourth consideration. On that hypothesis, there must be behind the action of the material energy a secret involved consciousness, cosmic, infinite, building up through the action of that frontal energy its means of an evolutionary manifestation, a creation out of itself in the boundless finite of the material universe. The apparent inconscience of the material energy would be an indispensable condition for the structure of the material world substance in which this consciousness intends to involve itself, so that it may grow by evolution out of its apparent opposite. For without some such device, a complete involution would be impossible. So it is necessary to have the full possibility of an evolution, to have a finality to the involution that reaches its apparent nadir. It must dive into what seems to be complete darkness, into a blank denial of its own being, so that this consciousness force can structure a cosmos which evolves stage by stage, phase by phase, towards the full revelation of what it always was, a divine being. So evolution is impossible without involution. And thus, inconscience is necessary. The superconscience must bury itself in the inconscience. And this is all occurring within the being of the Supreme, within the being who is conscious of his own infinity, who takes delight in his full force of awareness, and yet is willing to become apparently the opposite of all that it is by burying itself in this blank inconscience. If there is such a creation by the infinite out of itself, he writes, it must be the manifestation in a material disguise of truths or powers of its own being. The forms or vehicles of these truths or powers would be the basic, general, or fundamental determinants we see in nature. The particular determinants, which otherwise are unaccountable variations that have emerged from the vague general stuff in which they originate, would be the appropriate forms or vehicles of the possibilities that the truths or powers residing in these fundamentals bore within them. So you can see there's an ordering of being. If there is a great reason which expresses itself multiply and can constellate itself endlessly in the superconscience, this same ordering principle is within the inconscient, coming out. First come the general determinations, and then more variations and determinations expressed from those, from the fundamental to the particular. So the principle of free variation of possibilities natural to an infinite consciousness would be the explanation of the aspect of inconscient chance of which we are aware in the workings of nature, inconscient only in appearance, and so appearing because of the complete involution in matter, because of the veil with which the secret consciousness has disguised its presence. The principle of truths, real powers of the infinite imperatively fulfilling themselves, would be the explanation of the opposite aspect of a mechanical necessity which we see in nature, mechanical in appearance only, and so appearing because of the same veil of inconscience. It would then be perfectly intelligible why the inconscient does its works with a constant principle of mathematical architecture, of design, of effective arrangement of numbers, of adaptation of means to ends, of inexhaustible device and invention. One might almost say a constant experimental skill and an automatism of purpose. the appearance of consciousness out of an apparent inconscience would also be no longer inexplicable. So there is a power of chit shakti, of conscious force, conscious power, which is reflected in the mechanical powers emerging out of the inconscience. And we have now two principles. First, a principle of free variation of all possibles, which are accorded to infinite results in chance. That's the random side. And then, on the other, we have a principle of real powers of truth fulfilling themselves necessarily. And here we wind up with a balance between indeterminacy and necessity. They come into a kind of meeting in the cosmos, and we have the arrangement that we see. We look at it with the incomprehension of a mind, and we can't decide, is it random? Is it disconnected? Is the world acausal? Or do we look at it and say, no, it is determined. Things are shaped as of necessity, and all is caused. A law of indeterminism or a law of determinism, locked in an eonic struggle for supremacy, you might say, because we cannot, with our mind, find a philosophic solution to it. And you may be glad to know that that is where we will end tonight. We will suspend the scrutiny of this until next Sunday, which will be the Sunday just before the 24th of November, which is, of course, the Siddhi Day, the day of fulfillment. Well, let us turn to savitri. Always it brings beauty and solace to us. Tonight let's go to Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, and in the Godheads of the Little Life. This earth is not alone, our teacher and nurse. The powers of all the worlds have entrance here. In their own fields they follow the wheel of law and cherish the safety of a settled type. On earth, out of their changeless orbit throne, their law is kept, lost their fixed form of things. Into a creative chaos they are cast, where all asks order, but is driven by chance. Strangers to earth nature, they must learn earth's ways. Aliens or opposites, they must unite. They work and battle, and with pain agree. These join, those part, all parts and joins anew. But never can we know and truly live till all have found their divine harmony. Our life's uncertain way winds circling on. Our mind's unquiet search asks always light till they have learned their secret in their source, in the light of the timeless and its spaceless home, in the joy of the eternal soul and one. But now the light supreme is far away. Our conscious life obeys the inconscient's laws. To ignorant purposes and blind desires, our hearts are moved by an ambiguous force. Even our mind's conquests wear a battered crown. A slowly changing order binds our will. This is our doom until our souls are free. A mighty hand then rolls mind's firmaments back. Infinity takes up the finite's acts, and nature steps into the eternal light. then only ends this dream of nether life. Om Tathastu. Jai Ma. Namaste.